Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, an update on Brandon Lawson, our final thoughts on JonBenet Ramsey, and some notes on the show. And welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, by my superior co-host, Alice.
I feel like it's a trap. Like, what am I supposed to say to that?
Well, you know, guys, a terrible thing has happened. I don't know how I'm going to handle it. Alice got a promotion at work, and now she is my boss, and so I have to do everything she says, and I just don't know. Like, I don't know if I can do it.
But a good boss knows which people will not listen to instructions, so Brett, you're off the hook. Oh, my goodness.
No, I kid. Of course, I will do everything you say, Alice. Everything you say.
Hardly. Life is so crazy right now. Like, it's beyond crazy, Brett. And it's, like, so much fun to take a break from the craziness that is happening in our work life and step into my closet and record with you.
Yeah, we're in the middle of trial. We're 2 weeks into it. Well, it's going to be a four-week trial at least, I guess.
Oh, I don't think that's it. I think it's going to be longer.
That is my concern.
I think we're going to get out around Christmas.
Yeah. Well, that's fine. I mean, it's been fun. We can't comment on it too much, but maybe eventually we can tell you more about it. We'll tell you more about it when it's over, I guess. But yeah, we got trial tomorrow. We thought we'd take some time and record a podcast. So here we are. By the time you hear this, hopefully the trial will be over.
Oh my goodness, I hope. You know, I always sound a bit loopy, but I might sound super loopy today because I just completely ate my feelings. Brett, what is your, like, stress-eating food of choice?
My stress-eating food of choice? Well,
maybe
ice cream,
you don't do that,
probably.
But I do.
No, I do. What I like to do is get a pint of Ben & Jerry's half-baked, which is like cookie dough and brownie batter, and just eat the whole pint. That's what I like to do.
That's pretty good. Well, I did something. I used to do this like in my much younger days when I had a better metabolism, but I just buy, I think you know this, an entire bag of gummy bears and just like finish it off. And I definitely did that tonight, and I feel a little bit sick because I don't think my old body can like process the sugar like I could as a teenager.
Well, you know how I feel about gummy bears. I love gummy bears. Well, gummy bears are the ultimate.
I'll give you a surprise. You're going to find out in like 12 hours, but I'm bringing you some tomorrow.
Yes. That is awesome.
So you can think
Thanks,
about
boss.
That all night. before we go to trial, you could stuff a bunch of gummy bears in your mouth.
I might wait until after trial, because if I stuff them in my mouth before trial, that could be a...
That could be like really... That's super wise. And talk about passing the marshmallow test.
Yeah. I think I've only got a couple witnesses tomorrow. I think you have all the important ones, but still, I need to at least be awake.
We should be awake.
Well, guys, this is sort of a special episode. We don't have a new case for you. We thought we would do some updates. We talk about some JonBenet Ramsey and tell you a little bit about how the show is going. So we saved that part for the last because I know some of you don't care about the show. You just want to hear about the true crime. So we'll talk about the true crime first, but then we'll talk about the show some as well and how it is doing. And the first thing we want to talk about today is Brandon Lawson. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the Brandon Lawson case. We did a couple episodes on Brandon Lawson, probably been a year now, maybe a little bit longer. For those of you who don't know or have forgotten, Brandon Lawson left his home in Texas late at night. He starts driving to his father's home, which was a few hours away. He's on a dark and desolate road. No traffic, really just nothing out there, and at some point, his truck runs out of gas, and shortly thereafter, he calls 911, and he leaves this enigmatic, inexplicable 911 message, talking to this 911 operator. Of course, it's recorded, that people have pored over and tried to understand ever since, and he vanished into thin air, and there was really no trace of him. And it was one of those cases where you wondered if we'd ever have any idea what happened to Brandon. Well, early in February, there was a massive update in this case. His wife, LaDessa, posted on Facebook that, in fact, Brandon had been found. Now, that has not been 100% confirmed. The remains that they found are currently in testing, but it's Brandon. There's no question about it. The remains were found. I've read a mile from where his truck was left. I've also read 5 miles, so 1 to 5 miles from where his truck was abandoned. They found his shoes, they found his shorts, and they found a partial skeleton, including a skull. So I think one thing we can say for sure is the mystery about where Brandon ended up has been solved. We wanted to talk about this case for couple reasons. Number one, to give you that update and to see if we can draw some lessons from this, maybe some meta lessons that we can apply to all of true crime. One question that people have asked me is, what is the likelihood that a cause of death will be determined? Hard to say. If, for instance, Brandon was murdered and say he was shot, well, they have the skull, so if he were shot in the head, they would most likely be able to determine that because of the presence of a bullet hole. Obviously, if he was shot somewhere else, if there's no evidence on the skeleton, then the likelihood of proving that might be fairly insignificant. I think one of the things that's going to haunt this case is I don't think they'll be able to tell what the cause of death was. And I think the reason for that is that the cause of death was exposure. And only having a skeleton, you're not going to be able to prove that definitively. And so there will always be people out there, sort of conspiracy theorists, who believe that Brandon was murdered, that he was shot. I do think there are a couple theories that we can definitively rule out now, though. Now that we've found his body, there are a couple things. Number one, it wasn't the family that killed him. There have been people who have suspected the family since the very beginning. They've suspected LaDessa, and they've suspected Brandon's brother, who was one of the last people to talk to him. I say it wasn't the family because if it had been the family and the family were trying to cover this up, they would not have left his body there. They would have disposed of his body. If this was a murder and the family murdered him and they know that, they would have disposed of the body. They wouldn't be leading searches in that area. They wouldn't be encouraging people to look for him because obviously his body's going to be full of evidence. So I think you can definitively rule them out to the extent there's anybody who thought they were involved. Obviously, the theories that some people had that he abandoned his life, these are theories that we all rejected, that he abandoned his life, he didn't do that. He also wasn't spirited away by some drug cartel or, you know, some rogue police officer. If he was murdered by somebody, he was murdered there on that road. That person is likely a stranger, and if they did it, they'll never be found. Though I think this just confirms what Alice and I thought happened, which is that he was on drugs. He was undergoing some sort of psychotic break. He ran off into the wilderness, and he died of exposure. And his body was found right there, you know, not very far away at all.
Yeah, Brett. I mean, 1 to 5 miles, you know, whatever the distance is, that's definitely walkable. And it's very likely that he ended up where he took himself in terms of it was his own feet, right? He didn't get into a car. He'd be much further away if he got into a car, likely. And the fact that his body's still there, and I think we've talked about these kind of country roads and the brush, the density of the brush, how it could be really difficult to find someone. I don't know for a fact, but the fact that he was found as soon as they were able to search an area that they hadn't been able to search before leads me to believe that he was not deep into the brush. He was actually pretty close to the road. Meaning he was probably just walking and maybe sat down and laid down going to sleep because he felt sleepy from whatever drugs or just tired from walking however many miles and died from exposure in that way. The skeleton, you know, the fact that his shoes and his shorts and are all there with him suggests that really he just probably laid down and then died where he was. The cause of death thing, Brett, is going to be really hard. I don't think you're going to find much unless you see something like a bullet hole or a shattered skull, because it's been out in the elements for so long that wildlife could have gotten to it. You may see bite marks or you know, scratches on the bones, but that could be very, very likely from post-death, not the cause of death. I'm so glad he was found. For closure for his family, to wipe away some of these conspiracy theories out there about him, and just to have some closure, because it's devastating. This is so, so sad for his family, but at least they have some closure here. And we've talked about how in many, many kind of missing person cases, this is likely what happened. And I think in this case, Brandon's case, our theory bore out that in fact he just wandered off, and it's hard to find people.
And Alice, I know you had the chance to meet LaDessa at the CrimeCon last year in Austin, and I'm really glad that she and the rest of Brandon's family can have some sort of closure. They can have a funeral. They can have a service. They don't have to search anymore. And I think they also can feel pretty certain that they know what happened in this case. One person who deserves special credit is Jason Watts. He is an advocate for the family. You've probably heard him on Tim and Lance's show, Missing. They've done a lot on Brandon Lawson. And he is the person who was able to get permission from the landowner to actually search this land. We talked about on the podcast that one of the problems here was that there was a lot of private property, and people in Texas and really anywhere don't like people traipsing around their property. So he was able to get that permission, and they were able to find this skeleton. And I do think there's a lesson for this. I think in a lot of cases, people can get carried away with conspiracy theories about what happened. And a lot of times the answer is pretty clear. I think you're going to see this in the Jason Landry case. I think Jason is probably very close to where his car was found. I think you're going to see a similar thing there. Who knows? You might see this in Maura Murray one day, that you find her not too far away. And in these missing persons cases, it's really easy to go crazy and let your imagination run wild. But a lot of times, the simplest answer really is going to be the answer. And I think in the Brandon Lawson case, we have that definitively.
The Prosecutor's Podcast is brought to you by Progressive. What's one thing you'd purchase with a little extra savings? A weighted blanket, smart speaker, that new self-care trend you keep hearing about? Well, Progressive wants to make sure you're getting what you want by helping you save money on car insurance. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. discounts like having multiple vehicles on your policy. Progressive offers outstanding coverage and award-winning claim service. Day or night, they have customer support 24/7, 365 days a year. When you need them most, they're at their best.
A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at Progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary, discounts vary, and are not available in all states and situations.
All right, ladies, let's talk about something that may be a little uncomfortable to talk about because we women, we have a broad range of peri and postmenopausal symptoms. And I know for me, I want safe and effective non-drug solutions that I can trust. And that's why I'm excited that Bonafide is one of our sponsors. Bonafide creates proprietary natural medical products that have earned the uncompensated recommendation of over 8,300 doctors to their patients on an ongoing basis. Bonafide was created to give women an alternative to effectively relieve the symptoms that accompany hormonal fluctuations within our bodies, because every woman deserves relief without compromise. Bonafide seeks to provide women with naturally powerful remedies to safely treat the natural symptoms that occur throughout our lives, from PMS to menopause and everything else along the way. That's why you all should definitely give Bonafide a try today.
If you're interested in real relief without compromise, go to hellobonafide.com/prosecutors and use promo code prosecutors to get 20% off your first purchase when you subscribe to any product, and up to 56% off when you subscribe to multiple products. That's hellobonafide.com/prosecutors and code prosecutors, spelled PROSECUTORS, for up to 56% off at checkout. Alice, if we've said it once, we've said it 100 times. We are busy people, and we don't always have the time that we would like to have to provide healthy, delicious meals for our family. But that's where one of our newest sponsors, ButcherBox, comes in. They make it easy. ButcherBox is a subscription service. It takes the guesswork out of finding high-quality meat. And that's because ButcherBox sources their high-quality meat from partners with the highest standards for quality. Whether you're looking for grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, wild-caught seafood, or anything else, ButcherBox is the perfect solution for you.
Brett, I was so excited when my ButcherBox came because I feed a family of boys, hungry boys, and they especially love all cuts of beef. I can't buy enough beef for them, and to have it show up at my door at such convenience with just such high quality and an affordable price is such a gift. Now, every month, ButcherBox ships a curated selection of high quality meat right to your door. There's no antibiotics or added hormones, and each box contains between 8 to 14 pounds of meat. This is your chance to never have to shop for ground beef again. That's right. ButcherBox is giving new members free ground beef for life, plus get $10 off coupon. So go sign up at butcherbox.com/prosecute and get 2 pounds of ground beef free in every order for the life of your membership, plus a $10 off coupon. Log on to butcherbox.com/prosecute to claim this deal.
So with that, always interested to hear if you guys have any other questions on Brandon Lawson. It's really one of the great cases in true crime. And, you know, we're seeing some cases close recently, a lot of them because of DNA evidence, but this is a little different. And I hope for similar closure in a lot of the cases we've covered. So, JonBenet Ramsey, 9 episodes was just not enough.
We just wanted to make it an even 10.
Exactly. So we'll probably spend most of this episode talking about JonBenet because, oh my goodness, did you guys have thoughts.
No, Brett, I don't think anyone had any opinions whatsoever, and everyone was incredibly cordial throughout this entire process. Woo-wee! Let me just say, I thought we waded into it with Maura Murray. I thought we waded into it with Delphi. I thought we waded into it with Scott Peterson and Michael Peterson, but all of those combined does not even begin to touch the passion, shall we call it, that surrounds JBR.
Yeah, there's a lot of emotion in this case. I'm really surprised how emotional some people are and how personally they took this case. I mean, you would have thought we were insulting people's sisters when we suggested that one theory wasn't correct or that this piece of evidence wasn't really that relevant. I mean, people take this case far more seriously than I thought. I knew it would be controversial just because it's so popular and people have such strong opinions, but I had no idea how crazy it would be.
It was a different level because people in all the other cases who have very passionate followings, they're passionate for different reasons, right? Whether it's they want to see it solved or they have their own theories. But here, anything that was said was truly a personal attack on the very being of the person who held the opinion. And I was like, whoa, I'm not trying to question like your existence on this earth. But it seemed to be taken that way in many instances. And I think part of the reason is a lot of us grew up with this case. I don't remember a time before JonBenet Ramsey because I was about the same age. And I think I have grown up my entire life seeing her face at the grocery store on a tabloid, no matter the year. I mean, seemingly nonstop. It's like every month there's a new article on JonBenet Ramsey. And I really do think it's a case that has grown up with so many of us.
Yeah, I'm a little older than Alice. JonBenet is not the first thing I remember, but it certainly has been with us for, 25 years. It's a big chunk of time. And that is a lot of people's lives. So, and I get that. And I guess we should just go ahead and get a couple things out of the way. Number one, we are not being paid by the Ramseys. This was a popular theory, I guess, that somehow we were being paid by them. We had one person who said we needed to admit our relationship with the Ramseys. And they base this entirely on the fact that John Andrew Ramsey had tweeted that we reached out to him. And I guess they thought that was unusual that we reached out to him, as if we don't reach out to people in as many of the cases as we can. Obviously, we wanted to hear his perspective and anything he knew about this case. You know, sometimes we're more successful than others. The Mary Morris case, everybody talked to us, from people at the newspaper to the suspects to everybody in between. And that was great. And I think that added a lot of color. But we're not being paid by the Ramseys, and we don't have any special relationship with them. We also are not friends with Lynn Wood. This was another one, that Lynn Wood is our friend. Like, we're personally friends with him.
Oh, my gosh. Brett, is this embarrassing? When people started, like, just throwing vitriol at us that we're best friends with Lynn Wood, I turned to Brett and I said, who's Lynn Wood? I didn't know. I had no idea who Lynn Wood was.
Yeah, and it's like, no, I've never met Lynn Wood. I think it's Woods. One.
I don't know who he is.
I know him only by reputation because he represented the Ramseys. He represented the guy who didn't bomb the Atlanta Olympics. And he represented Donald Trump in the last election. And somehow we're friends with him. And this is our effort to bolster his case. It's just bizarre. I love the fact that people think we have that much reach, that if we came out one way, Lynn Wood's going to be better off, but we do not know him and we are not friends with him.
I mean, let me just put it this way. A lot of you said this. I didn't know the facts of this case very well. I knew what was the headlines. That's really all I knew about this case. And when we started episode one, I think I said this in episode one, even in episode two, I had no idea how I was going to come out. And I think you can tell, like, at first I make fun of, not make fun, I don't try to make fun, but like, I thought both theories were absurd for different reasons, right? We went back and forth. And it wasn't until we were maybe halfway through recording that my own theory started to take take shape. But for me, I just didn't know the facts of this case because I think I've told you guys before, but these kinds of cases make me so sad. So I didn't, before we researched this case, know much about it.
Now, I did, and I knew how I was going to come out in this case. And that was another thing. Somebody was like, you guys made up your mind before you even started recording. You knew what you were going to say. And it's like, yeah, I did. Like, we had a, I don't know, a 30, 40, 50 page outline. It was 20-something thousand words on this case.
It was so long, Brett.
I knew where we were going to come out. That's. I'm glad that I guess we often do such a good job of remaining neutral that you guys feel like we are coming to the conclusion as you are as we're doing the show. But you got to remember, we've done all the research. We've been prepared to do the show before the show starts. So by the time the show starts, we often will have an idea. It doesn't mean we had an idea going into the research, but we have an idea by the time we start the show, even if it's not fully formed, and even if that idea changes a little bit as we go, because talking to Alice often does clarify things for me, and I can be undecided at the beginning, and after talking to Alice for 5 or 6 episodes, have an idea. But I certainly had a pretty strong feeling about how I was going to come out in this case.
And I do want to say this, because we do extensive outlines. You can probably tell from this is conversation-based, because, I mean, when you talk to someone who is just – this is meant to be a compliment, Brett, but, like, really, when you talk to, like, other smart people, you make me better at discussing these cases. Like, you make me think of things as we're going, so we're really not reading a script. This is not a scripted show. I think that's pretty obvious based on our pronunciation. But someone said, like, we scripted out and wrote and then read our theories. Just so you know, there are parts that we read, certainly, like the narrative parts. We want to get facts right, read transcripts right, that sort of thing for accuracy. But both of our theories were off the cuff. I'm trying to think. I don't think I was looking at anything. I was staring into space when I was spouting off my theory. But just to give you a little insight in how the show is done, when it comes to our theories, our outline actually says Alice's theory, blank, Brett's theory, blank. And we don't write out for each other what we think the other person's theory is, or give a preview of our theory to each other. So that's completely unscripted. There is quite literally a blank in our outline. Just to, for those of you who have any sort of a interest in knowing how our planning works.
Yeah. And even if we did write it out, I don't know why that would be a problem, but we do. We just sort of do those off the top of our head. And, you know, not that it matters, but yeah, we have an outline and it guides our discussion, but we're not a scripted show and we don't go by a script. But yeah, so those are sort of the initial things I wanted to talk about before we got into some of the details about the case and things that people had raised that they thought were interesting. One thing I'll say that people have asked a lot, and I've answered individually a lot, but I'll just go ahead and mention here. Some people have asked whether or not Santa Claus suits were ever made with beaver fur, and I actually did find a rather expensive Santa Claus suit that was made with beaver fur, and I've sent that link to some people who've asked. But interesting thing, does it have anything to do with the murder? I don't know. If you're a fan of the Santa Claus theory, maybe it does. It is intriguing. The beaver fur is something no one's ever been able to nail down, so who knows? Personally, I find the Santa Claus thing to be really fascinating. The statement that JonBenet made, I was pretty convinced by Alice's discussion of how children are and how accurately did this person remember exactly what JonBenet said. And I kind of feel like it's probably a red herring along with everything else. I don't think you can discount it completely, but it probably wasn't Santa Claus.
Making people mad again, Brett, on episode 10 of JonBenet.
And it's always interesting, the people who think it's Patsy, well, and we got this a lot. You mentioned Santa Claus, and they're just all over you. And they're like, it can't be Santa Claus because he didn't match the DNA. And it's like, wait, I thought you didn't believe in the DNA. I thought the DNA was worthless. The DNA is I guess only good if it rules out the suspect you don't like, apparently. That is what I learned about DNA in this case.
And by the way, I think we're coming in kind of hot because we just finished reading like so many comments. And by so many comments, I mean hundreds of comments a day. So if we seem, and also we might be loopy because we're in trial. So there might be a lot of laughing just because of sheer exhaustion and gummy bears on my front. But also just know that we do read all your comments, and I think it's awesome. Just, you know, when we are in court, when we do our jobs, our day job, we want vigorous discussion because that refines. That's how you refine a diamond, right? A diamond is rough and quite literally tumbles in this machine with other diamonds and hits against each other in order to be refined and shined and beautiful. And that's what I think vigorous, intellectual, honest discussion results in, something that is, you know, hopefully closer to the truth if both people are coming at it. So I know a lot of people were saying, you know, if you don't agree with Alice and Brett, then, you know, they'll be angry at you. And the answer is no. This is why we're in the professions we're in. We love this kind of debate. Brett and I just like sit here and like shoot the breeze and disagree with each other all the time. Maybe you guys don't hear it, but please know that we love this type of discussion. That's why we're kind of we seem kind of like light right now, because this is what we love. We're fighting, but in a fun way, right? We're intellectually having this discussion. So know that we enjoy this, and we hope you come at it with that perspective.
And I'll just say this: if you don't discuss things with your friends, somebody's going to discuss them with you eventually, and you're not going to be ready for it. You know, we're talking about trial. The defense is going to bring up your weaknesses. Yeah, if you're in trial. And if you haven't already addressed that with your friends and sort of went back and forth on it and decided what your strongest points are and your best arguments are, somebody's going to bring it up eventually. So we do love debate and discussion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I know I can already feel, because we're kind of spicy right now, and I feel like someone's going to write in and say, you know, you're much too dismissive or whatever you may interpret our tones of voice to be. But I wanted to explain that we're excited because this is what we love. We love this type of discussion.
Yeah. And so one thing that people brought up that I think is actually a really interesting question, and we may seem kind of all over the place on it just because it's very difficult to nail down, is when is behavior something that is useful? And so to give you some examples of this, like, we dismiss a lot of behavior. So we don't put much stock into, you know, what Patsy said in her interview with CNN, or how she looked, or, you know, did she cry or did she not cry, or did John look nervous or did he not look nervous, or any of that stuff that some people put a lot of stock into, or what her voice sounded like on the 911 call, or what they were doing when they were waiting for the ransom call to come in. We don't put a lot of stock in that, but we do put stock, for instance, in the idea that it seems unimaginable that two parents who've just discovered that their daughter's been accidentally killed or seriously wounded by their son would, in order to cover it up, sexually assault her and garrote her. So which is it? Does behavior matter? Does it not matter? And the answer is, it depends. And I think that is the best you can do. Look, they're sort of deep behavioral things. The thing about the parents doing that to their daughter, that is so out of the norm and out of the ordinary and such an extreme thing for a person to have to do. Now, people can do extreme things in extreme situations, but it is simply not common for people who have no prior history of violence, no prior history of sexual assault, to nevertheless do something like that, be capable, physically capable, mentally capable of wrapping that cord around their daughter's neck, pulling it tight to the point that if you look at the pictures, I mean, you know, it's so constricted. Like, it's hard to describe it. You just kind of have to look at it if you can bear to do that. And not only do that, but take a paintbrush and sexually assault their daughter with it. That is different than which way did she look when she answered a question. And I think when you think about sort of FBI behavioral profiles, they are looking at stuff like that. It's one of the reasons that John Douglas feels like the parents couldn't do it, because he does not think they are capable of that. And that's the kind of behavior he is analyzing, not the sort of more surface level or maybe more superficial or more in the moment. The behavior that is the reaction to trauma, the reaction to fear, that is so much more ephemeral, difficult to nail down, and personal to each person than something like sexually assaulting and garroting your daughter to cover up a crime.
Yeah, I think that's right, Brett. And I think there's some inconsistencies in theories when people say, well, of course a parent is capable of doing, like physically capable, like can physically overpower, you know, JonBenet to do these things. But we have said, oh, it has to be logically consistent for your theory, right? Because I think most people's theories for the parents is that it was an accident. If it was the parent who did it, if it was Patsy who did it, it was an accident. She got angry because of, you know, wetting the bed or soiling underpants and then accidentally kills her daughter, or they're covering something up. Neither of those are kind of the pre-planned with the physically capable of overpowering your child while she's clawing at you to garrote her to finish her off. Like, so it's either that they brutally and cold-heartedly, calculatedly decided how to murder their child, which is inconsistent with what we know about them, or they did something far beyond what they needed to do to cover up a murder. Or I'm sorry, yeah, to cover up an accidental killing. And that's where I think people start to lose. They say, well, they're capable of doing it. Parents are capable of doing those things all the time. And yes, we see those cases. And those parents who do that, we usually can look back into their history and point to a series of patterns of behavior that make them capable of doing something like that. Not just quite literally, they have two hands that can make a garrote.
Yeah, and this is a really important point that Alice is making, and we had some straw man arguments made against us on this. And straw man, for those of you who don't know, is when you take sort of the least charitable view of your opponent's view and you attack that. And it's not really their view, and it's a weakened view, and it makes it easy for you to win. But you don't really accomplish anything because you're not actually addressing their point. So what we would get some was, I can't believe they say parents couldn't do this. What about, and then point to this murder, right? Like whether it's Darla Routier or Jeffrey McDonald or the woman who drove her kids into the lake or any number of crimes, or people were like, well, I'm a caseworker and I see parents who beat their kids and all those other things. Parents can do these things. Parents absolutely can do horrible, evil things to their kids. That is not the point. The question is, did these parents exhibit the kind of behavior that would lead you to believe they would do this to their child, not out of anger, not out of hate, not out of malice, but in order to cover up a crime, whether it was their own accidental killing of JonBenet, or Burke's accidental killing of JonBenet? That's the question you have to answer. And people say things like, well, I could never imagine him doing that. He seemed like such a nice guy, or he just snapped. And in reality, people don't tend to snap. Typically, the behavior that you see from people is the behavior that they have exhibited for a very long time. The thing you see, the quote-unquote snapping, is just the culmination of that behavior. Often, behavior doesn't come out of nowhere. And I think that is particularly true when you have child abuse. Typically, parents don't just start abusing their children. If they're abusing their children, they've been doing it for a while. So here, we have no evidence of that. So you have to assume that these parents, who've never been anything but good parents to their kids, nevertheless would do this to JonBenet. Now, some people said things like, well, aren't you assuming that they're good people? Isn't that something you're assuming? That you're assuming that they're not capable of this? And I would just say, number one, I am making an assumption there, but it's an assumption based on sort of baseline human behavior and the way people tend to be and what we know about them. Like I said, we don't have any evidence of any sort of prior history. And I think just as importantly, the people who think Patsy did this are making all sorts of assumptions about her. They're assuming that she was abusive, or they're assuming that she's the kind of person who would strike her child with this amount of force over a bedwetting incident. That is a huge assumption that people are making about Patsy. And it's a necessary assumption in order for their theory to work. I think my baseline assumption, which is they are what they have always appeared to be, which is just normal people with kids, is a much safer assumption to make and one that is more likely correct. And I also think, once again, as Alice said, this is not just a murder. This is a brutal assault on this child. Whether it was done to cover up a crime or not, it is a brutal, brutal assault. And that is a bar you have to overcome. The brutality of this assault tells you something about the person who committed it. And to me, when I look at the assault, I don't see parents covering up a crime.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't get over the brutality. A lot of these theories, or a lot of people's kind of gripes at what we had to say, I don't think accounts for the brutality of what this little girl did. I don't, you can hear what I had to say about my theory, but I don't think this person accidentally did these things to JonBenet. I think the two horrific actions taken upon her, either of which would have killed her, were done on purpose and with purpose. She wasn't dropped accidentally. She wasn't thrown across the room. She wasn't hit out of anger, but it was in order to inflict the death blow on two different occasions.
Yeah, and we can talk more about behavior as we talk about cases. Like I said, I think you have to take behavior for what it's worth. I never tell people to ignore behavior. If there's something that strikes you, then consider it, because I think it is a natural human ability to read other people. I do think sometimes that can be short-circuited by extreme circumstances. And the thing about crime is you typically are seeing people in really extreme circumstances. So behavior that in an ordinary setting might tell you something about them, it may tell you less in that extreme circumstance. So just remember that whenever you're looking at behavior.
And Brett, that's a great point, because a lot of people said, you know, it's just their opinion. And that is absolutely true. And all of you are more than welcome to have your own opinions as well. But we are not behavior analysts. That's absolutely true. I have no training in that. But what we do on a day-to-day basis is see people in extremely stressful circumstances, whether because they have witnessed something extremely traumatizing or they are put in extremely stressful circumstances because they're testifying in court or, you know, with agents or law enforcement or what have you. And it makes people act in certain ways. And after you've seen thousands of people put in these circumstances, they start falling into categories. I'll see someone and I don't know them. I don't know if they're lying or not. But I'm like, ah, you fall into this bucket. You know, this bucket of you think you know everything and you think everything that's coming out of your mouth is being bought by everyone who's listening to it. Or I'm like, huh, wow, you are losing it. You are so nervous. You're just, anything I tell you, you're going to agree with me, which is super dangerous as well, right? And so after seeing thousands of people in these circumstances, you just begin to see patterns emerge. And that's where we're drawing from. And does that make it a perfect science? Of course not. But we are called upon to do that type of judgment, to decide who to believe, who to use in our cases, who to put before a grand jury, who to put before a petite jury. And, you know, if you ever were to serve in a jury, you're actually given that charge by the judge to say, all of you lay people who are serving your civic duty, you should use your own judgment and decide whether or not to believe the witness in front of you. Don't listen to the lawyers. Don't listen to whether they believe these people are telling the truth or not. Use your own judgment. And where does that judgment come from? What Brett just said, our kind of innate ability to suss out the truth. And so we call upon our juries to do that, and all of you can do that. And we just happen to be, you know, in a position where we get to see this over and over and over and begin to see patterns emerge. Do people fall outside of those patterns? Absolutely. Have you ever seen a bell curve? Exists, because there are extreme circumstances on either side. So we're not going to get it right every time, but there is a basis from which we are making these judgments.
Another thing that I knew would be controversial, but I guess I didn't think it would be as controversial as it was the pineapple and whether or not the pineapple was part of fruit cocktail. And we had people who just said we lied about it. We made it up. That was their statement. We just made up the fact that there were other things in her stomach besides pineapple, which kind of blew my mind. I knew the pineapple was really important to some people in their theory, but my mind was kind of blown by the people who were willing to say, we just made it up. So there is evidence, though, that we can point to.
So from Paula Woodward's book, the exact material in JonBenet's stomach and intestines was first discussed with experts at the University of Colorado on October 15th, 1997. And that's in the Boulder Police Department report number 1-1156, more than 10 months after JonBenet was killed. Their reports about the contents of her stomach and proximal area were given to the Boulder Police Department more than a year later in January of 1998. You can find that information in the Boulder Police Department report number 1-1349. 1 year after JonBenet's death. And that's when the mystery deepened and the misconception about what JonBenet actually ate was discovered. According to previously unreleased Boulder Police Department reports, laboratory testing revealed that JonBenet also ate cherries and grapes as well as pineapple. Remnants of cherries were found in the stomach or proximal area of her small intestine. Quote, another item besides pineapple was cherries. End quote. That is from BPD report number 1-1348. In that same report, it says, quote, another item besides pineapple was grapes. And that is still from BPD report number 1-1348. Another report expands on the grapes, saying, quote, grapes including skin and pulp. End quote. And that is from BPD report number 1-1349. So that's looking directly at the investigative file.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There were grapes and cherries in her stomach and small intestine. That's just a fact. It's a fact. You just have to deal with it. I don't know what to tell you. It just is a fact. And some people, and we said this in the show, some people were like, but it's not in the autopsy report. The autopsy report is just what the person is seeing at the time. There are a lot of things from the autopsy that are sent off. They took JonBenet's stomach contents and they saved them, which is something they often do. And remember, when the person who was doing the autopsy looked in the stomach, he thought he saw something consistent with pineapple. It's not like it wasn't like bright yellow, obviously pineapple. That's what he thought it was. It had been digested to some extent. People debate that about how much it had been digested, but that was his initial thought. He didn't see the grapes and the cherries, but that doesn't mean they're not there. They say the stomach contents, and it was only about 6 months later that Boulder finally got around to sending those off to be analyzed at the University of Colorado, and they looked at them, and they found these cherries, and they found these grapes, and they seemed to be pretty close to where the pineapple was. So I don't know what to tell you. They're in her stomach. They tell us something, and you just have to deal with that. And I'm sorry if that is a problem for your theory, but you have to face the fact that that was inside JonBenet's stomach, and I really don't know what else to say about it.
So we won't.
Yeah, so we can move on. One question we talked about a little bit that we thought was really important is what came first, the skull fracture or the strangulation? And we got a lot of emails from medical personnel who had some expertise in this, and there was one in particular that I thought was really interesting, and so I'm going to read to you a lot from this email this person sent. Now, they wanted their identity to be kept secret, which I totally understand, and we're going to do that. Okay, so what came first, strangulation or head trauma? Please keep in mind that the order of events may not reflect the order of the cause of death. While the ligature was certainly applied first, the head trauma was likely the first to cause death. There is no question these happened one right next to the other on a timeline, but there are several things to note in the autopsy report that indicate unmistakably that strangulation came first. 1. The presence of petechia in the sclera, mucosal membranes, and around the eyelids and ligature line. Petechial hemorrhage can only occur if the patient's heart is beating when the ligature is applied. To understand why, it must be remembered that the number one priority of all the body's systems and organs is to ensure that the brain has a constant and steady flow of blood to deliver oxygen to the brain. The pressure in the arteries is far greater than the pressure in the veins, as arterial blood has the pump of the heart directly behind it, forcefully propelling it out to the body with each beat. This pressure is dispersed as the blood reaches its destination and sent back to the heart via the veins in what is called venous return. The pressure behind the flow of blood is then so limited that veins are equipped with valves to prevent backflow. With this in mind, when a ligature is tied around the neck, the greater pressure in arterial flow forces blood into the head and neck above the ligature at a faster rate than it can flow out. This is ongoing up until the point when the compression of the ligature is strong enough to cut off even arterial flow. The massively increased pressure in the head and neck presents in part as petechial hemorrhaging as the smallest vessels begin to burst. Of course, it goes without saying, no pulse, no arterial flow, no petechial hemorrhage. Little or no external bleeding despite clearly catastrophic head trauma. This correlates with the above with a bit of a caveat. What made the injury 100% fatal, had it occurred in and of itself, were the subarachnoid hemorrhaging and subdural hematoma bleeding in and around the brain found at autopsy. At first, this may seem odd with the assertion that strangulation occurred first. Massive bleeding within the brain would say there had to be a heartbeat to get it there, right? This shows how close the two events were. However, as described above, the body's priority is to make sure the brain gets blood. Human physiology has a ridiculous number of stopgaps to preserve life. When the body senses that the brain is not getting the blood flow necessary for any reason, a ligature in this case, peripheral vessels will constrict, limiting blood flow to extremities and shunt it to the heart, lungs, and brain. The heart will then start to beat faster, and blood pressure will initially increase. This very effectively improves perfusion of the brain momentarily. If external factors causing decreased blood flow to the brain are not corrected within a reasonable time period, the patient cycles the drain and dies. This makes it clear that because perfusion of the brain is such a priority, it will be the last part of the body to be depleted of blood after all other areas of the body have been shut down. It now makes sense that there could be massive bleeding within the brain, but little superficial blood loss. In the case of the stripe being first, bruising and swelling are apparent because blood supply to the superficial tissues is still within normal limits. There is no constriction of the vessels supplying those. A part of the body's process is correcting low oxygen levels to the brain. Again, outside of an unknown factor, oxygen levels should be fine. But that's the problem with this case. There are so many unknown factors. In the case of strangulation being first, why is there limited apparent external trauma in the setting of low oxygen levels? The body senses decreased oxygen levels to the brain, causing constriction of the vessels and superficial tissue, limiting blood flow to them. The result is little blood available to make bruising or swelling readily apparent in that tissue. This is the body, in essence, shifting the volume of blood from the outside, skin, to the inside, brain and heart. You see, the body senses low oxygen levels, but it doesn't know why. Therefore, it tries to boost the amount of blood coming into the brain and hopes some of that blood is carrying more oxygen. When we breathe in, the oxygen that enters the lungs is transferred to the blood supply in a process called cellular respiration. That urge you feel after you've held your breath for a while? Well, the brain knows when it's not getting the oxygen it needs. It's sending an SOS to the respiratory center of the brain, stimulates the respiratory drive, which then pretty much screams, breathe, damn it, to the rest of your body. And if all else is on the up and up, you can no longer hold your breath because you feel you're forced to take a breath in. Because of the more external location of the trachea and the more internal orientation of the arteries, blood flow to the brain is maintained to some extent for a time, even after compression of the airway. But because of the low oxygen levels, not a whole lot of it is going to the superficial tissue. Blood is still flowing to the brain in the presence of low oxygen levels. It just doesn't have the oxygen it needs to feed the brain. So no breath equals no oxygen going into the lungs and passing into the bloodstream, equals low oxygen levels in the brain, equals constriction of peripheral vessels and reaction, equals blood flow to superficial tissue decreases, equals brain bleeds, but superficial tissue appears intact. I thought this was really interesting because we had said it's not necessarily the case that she was strangled first, even though she has the petechia, because maybe she was hit in the head and she was on the verge of death, and then she was strangled, and so she still would have had this. What this person is explaining is this mystery of why there's no external evidence of her head being struck is because she had been strangled. And so the blood is not flowing to the skin and to the scalp. It's flowing to the brain. And I think this is important for a couple reasons. Obviously, it's possible to strike someone in the head and not break the skin, though we all know that's a little counterintuitive because our experience with strikes to the head is that they bleed a lot. That's what we experience when we see those. But it is possible. But it's not just that. This one thing that this person notes I think is really interesting is there's no swelling and there's no bruising either. There's really no sign on the exterior of JonBenet's head that she has been struck as viciously as she has been. And that has led this person to believe it's pretty clear, in their opinion, that she was strangled first and then struck, and that's why there's no external evidence of injury.
That's fascinating. Because we were going back and forth, how could it be that you could have such a traumatic head injury and not be able to see it until the autopsy? And this makes so much sense. I have no medical training, so I'm, you know, but what they've explained and the way they've explained it makes a lot of sense here.
Yeah, and it's great that there are so many of you out there. We got a lot of emails along these lines. It seemed like most people who had medical training did think strangulation happened first. Now, obviously, that is just anecdotal. They did not, it's not as if they examined her body, you know. In many ways, it's like some random handwriting person looking at blurry copies on the internet and trying to decide who wrote the letters. But I thought it was interesting. It's something I wanted to share with you guys since we don't have this expertise. If you are somebody out there with medical knowledge and you disagree with this assessment, well, I'd love to hear that too. And we will share that because we're all about sharing sort of competing theories and ideas on the show. Alice, before we continue, I'm excited to talk about a very different kind of sponsor for this episode, the Jordan Harbinger Show. As we've told you guys, this is a podcast you should definitely check out since you're a fan of high-quality, fascinating podcasts hosted by interesting people. The show covers such a wide range of topics through weekly interviews with heavy-hitting guests. And there are a ton of episodes you'll find interesting since you're a fan of this show. As I've said before, Jordan's interview with Sammy the Bull Gravano is not to be missed. And if you think you might be a psychopath, his episode, Are You a Psychopath?, is one you will have to listen to.
There's an episode for everyone, though, no matter what you're into. The show covers stories like how a professional art forger somehow made millions of dollars while being chased by the feds and the mafia. And Jordan's also done an episode all about birth control and how it can alter the partners we pick. We really enjoy this show, and we think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Alice, the last time we were recording, I was talking about how I had cereal for dinner. And I was telling you that one of the problems with cereal is there's too many carbs, and even if you think you're eating healthy, you're actually not. Well, that's where our sponsor, Magic Spoon, comes in. If you are like me and you're trying to cut down on carbs and sugar and all the unhealthy things that's in our food today, and you think, man, I can't eat anything anymore, that's where Magic Spoon comes in. We may be trying to eat healthier, but eating healthier doesn't mean it has to be boring. And Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff.
That's right. Magic Spoon is 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. That's only 140 calories a serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. And the variety pack has 4 flavors, including cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. I love mixing the peanut butter and cocoa together to make a peanut butter cup
bowl of deliciousness. So go to magicspoon.com/prosecute to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code PROSECUTE at checkout to save $5 off your order. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/prosecute and use the code PROSECUTE to save $5 off.
Well, that's all we have on John Bonet and Brandon Lawson. If you're only here for the true crime, we'll see you next week. We'll do another case next week. But we did want to talk a little bit about the show with those of you who enjoy hearing how the show's going and how things are doing. The first thing I have to say is thank you guys so much for your support and for telling your friends. And welcome to the tons of new listeners that we have. I think in the last 4 months or so, the show has essentially doubled in its listenership. We have about twice as many people listening now as we did in, say, October, which is crazy. And that's a testament to you guys. I'm not sure what led to that, to be honest with you. I don't know if it's just word of mouth or if it was Morbid giving us a shout out on their show. Awesome show you guys should all listen to. Not that they need our endorsement, but they are awesome. And it was great that they did that. Not all big shows give shout outs to the other shows they listen to. So that was awesome. I don't know where you guys are coming from, but there's a ton of you. So thank you so much for listening to the show. You guys are awesome. And you've taken us to sort of heights that I don't think we ever thought we would get to. And if we were going to get there, we thought it would be a lot longer than it has been. So thank you guys for that.
Yeah, no, it's been so cool to see so many new listeners and people kind of giving us their first impressions. We've been doing this now for, you know, a bit of time. And so we forget what it's like to be coming at this new. So thank you guys for writing to us and letting us know that you found us.
And now that there are a bunch of new people, we have to reiterate a few things that we've said before. If you've written into us and talked about how much you love the show, but you hate hearing about our kids, sorry, you're going to hear about our kids. That is part of the show that is not going to change. And as we often say, we make this show for ourselves and for the people who really enjoy it. We're not going to change anything about the show, ever. So this is the show. It's the way it's going to be. And we're happy you guys are here. But if there are parts of it you don't like, sorry. That's the show. And that's how we're going to do it.
Now, that doesn't mean we don't love hearing when we've gotten something wrong or that you disagree with us. That's very different than how we do the show. What we mean is the format of the show and the incredibly, surprisingly controversial theme song that both our kids love. So that's not, the song's not going anywhere.
Yes. As we've said from the very beginning, the song will never change. And that's just how we see it. And look, I mean, obviously a lot of people like it, and you know, those of you, it's just funny because we do enjoy hearing from you guys, but it is funny because sometimes people will write to us and say, oh, you know, we love your show, but I really wish you guys did less banter, or you talked less amongst yourself, or you told fewer stories about your kids, or you had fewer asides. And I'm like, but that's why the show is the way it is. So if you enjoyed the show, maybe you actually like that part. I mean, maybe you don't, but... And look, there are some great shows out there that do that. Like Court Junkie talks about trials and everything else and has no banter whatsoever. Case File. I mean, there's lots out there. Big Mad True Crime, one of my favorite shows. I mean, her whole thing is that small talk sucks, and she just talks about the cases. So they're out there, but they're not us. So glad to have you guys, but just know there are some things that aren't going to change. Along those lines about... everybody showing up. I wanted to give you guys some updates on stats because I know people enjoy that sort of thing. So our number one country, not surprisingly, is the United States. The United Kingdom is number two, Canada close behind, and then Australia, which reflects the people we hear from. We hear from folks from Australia all the time. The number one state in the United States is, no shock here, Texas. Texas is our number one state with a full 10% of our listeners in Texas. Followed by California. Top cities, it's a tie. Chicago and Houston are our top cities, followed close behind Fort Worth and then Dallas. So once again, Texas is big, and you can see that.
Yay, Texas.
Yay, Texas. Yay, Alice's Texas. Folks are obviously coming through. Everybody who listens to us is just Alice's friends. So.
That's definitely not true, but I am a proud Texan.
Now, this surprised me. As someone who's a proud Android user, it surprises me that 88% of you listen to this show on a Apple device, which kind of blew my mind. 88%. I mean, that is a really high percentage, but hey, go Apple. Big fans of Apple anyway. So anyway, so those are some stats.
Talk about like that. That was eye opening for me, Brett, too. I was like, man, I did not know what a monopoly they had.
I didn't either. I mean, I've never owned an iPhone except for work. Seems like all work phones are iPhones. I've always been an Android guy.
Maybe,
man,
we have a lot of people listening to us on their work phones at work.
There you go. There you go. By the time you guys hear this, we will have had 5 million downloads all time, which is insane.
Really?
I know a lot of y'all remember. I know, it's crazy.
I thought we were in like, I don't know, the 6 digits.
No.
I'm way behind. I missed something.
Maybe after this episode.
Very possibly.
Yeah. You guys may recall right around our 1 year anniversary, we had just hit 1 million downloads. So you guys have ramped it up in last year because we're now at around 5. And we've got our 2 year anniversary coming up in May, and we're really excited about that. And speaking of May, we will be at CrimeCon in Vegas. I hope you guys will join us. We've already heard from a bunch of you who are going to go. We'd really like to meet you and talk about some of these cases in person. Well, I think that's all I've got today, Alice. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, thanks for sticking with us throughout trial. And we really can't wait to meet so many of you very soon.
Yeah, and obviously email us with any of your thoughts, prosecutorspod@gmail.com, @prosecutorspod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We have the gallery on Facebook where you can chat with other folks. Got 1,100 users on the gallery now, and they have a lot of robust conversations. We have a subreddit where you can also join any conversations you want to take a part in. There's really just a lot of ways to get in touch with us. We try and respond to as many of your messages as possible. If I haven't responded, I apologize. That is my fault. There's just been so many lately. I mean, I don't know. It's getting a little overwhelming, frankly. I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying it's really hard to keep up. So if I don't respond to you, it's not because I didn't like your message. In fact, if your message is really thought-provoking, I'm probably going to do the thing that I do where I read it, then I mark it as unread and think, I'm really going to have to think about my response. And then it, you know, gets lost. I never respond. So if you never got responded to, it's probably because your message was just so amazing that I needed time to think about how I was going to respond. And then it slipped my mind. But reach out to us. We love you guys. You guys are awesome. Keep telling your friends. Keep leaving those 5-star reviews. And we can't wait to see you at CrimeCon. Well, Alice, that is all we have for today. Next week, we will be back with a new episode, a new case, not just us blabbing for an hour. And we can't wait to dive into that with you. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors.
I just thought someone should do it. Wait, so what cereal did you eat tonight?
I just got some like Great Grains or whatever.
Oh, I don't think I've had that.
Yeah, I mean, I like cereal, but it's bad for you. Unless you're eating the Magic Spoon.
Is it bad for you?
It's just a ton of carbs. I don't know. It depends on how you feel about carbs. Now, the Great Grains is supposed to have like fiber and stuff in it.
Love. Which is supposed to be.
I love sugar. I just pure sugar. I can just eat sugar. It's like packets of it. Just pour it down my throat.
I'm just, my brain's just not working as quickly. That whole, like, your brain even functioning when everything else is shutting down. That's how I feel right now. When you were reading that, I was like, oh, is that what's happening to my brain right now?
Stream the biggest movies and TV shows for free on Pluto TV. Watch movies like Titanic and G.I. Joe The Rise of Cobra, plus TV shows like CSI and Star Trek The Next Generation. Starting this month, check out the 24/7 Stargate channel exclusively on Pluto TV. Plus hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows absolutely free. Download the free Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start watching today.